This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll talk with Nick Mantis, who is the creator of the upcoming Gene Shepherd documentary. He's been working on it for a while, and we've got a status report on this look into the master storyteller from Hammond, Indiana. Also today, a conversation with Pete Novak, Jr., who's the president and CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors, on how home sales have fared here in Northwest Indiana at the end of 2017 and a peak at 2018 as well, too. And we'll also bring back our conversation with State Representative Hal Slager as we get ready for another legislative session next month. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Local filmmaker Nick Mantis has been working for years on this documentary about the life and career of the master storyteller Gene Shepherd, Hammond's own Gene Shepherd, the fellow that you hear here on Lakeshore Public Radio and our weekly broadcast that Ryan Priest puts together. Before we talk with Nick here in the studio, let's bring back a part of this conversation that Gene Shepherd had, when he visited the Maryville Library back in 1984. He was talking about his writing, and at that time it was the course, the new movie, A Christmas Story, has some interesting comments about that, too. And here's just an excerpt of the conversation that Gene Shepherd had to the audience at the Maryville Library.
For years, I've been writing and doing television and movies and one thing and another about a mythical town. And don't forget, I write about a mythical town. I don't write about him. You must understand that. No, listen carefully. You may learn something about my writing. I write about a town which I call Holman, Indiana. Not based on the street of Holman, but a mythical town that is a composite of all these northern Indiana towns. Beautiful downtown Whiting. East Chicago in the dusk. Indiana Harbor in the fly season. And all these towns, you see, I have put into a composite town. And it's like Faulkner with creating a composite Mississippi town, which he created. So I've created this southern or this Indiana town. It's a fiction. Now, I have had people, and my stories are fiction too, by the way, and I've had people who swear they remember when certain things happen, which really scares me. Because that makes me wonder about the whole goddamn study of history. I'm sure there are old, ancient families in Georgia who will tell you that their great-grandfather served under Rhett Butler. Now, a lot of you are saying, what's funny about that? Famous Civil War. They composite when you're creating fiction. Now, how many of you saw A Christmas Story? Well, that never happened, you know. This came right out of this diseased Indiana brain. Now, I'm sure a lot of you said, well, that's just like a thing that happened to me. The essence of good fiction is to actually convince you that you did this thing, in spite of the fact that everybody in your family knows you didn't. But you're now so totally convinced that you swear that you went. I even got a letter from somebody after the movie opened. This is a fascinating letter. It came to me. It says, you're going to be pleased to know. They were writing from Crown Point or some other cultural center. And she wrote me a note. And she says, dear Mr. Shepherd, I'm sure you'll be pleased to know that my uncle was the Santa Claus. It came out of my head. I never went to see Santa Claus in my life as a kid. And he remembers you asking him for the baby gun. Well, I'll tell you, maybe the reason I don't come back to this town much is the minute I get out on Calumet Avenue, I start getting this nervous feeling in my stomach, because right down the street is Hammond High, where some of the most hellish moments in my life were lived.
Now, if you want to hear the full conversation, you can go to the Lake County Public Library YouTube channel and take a look at this this conversation, of which actually was arranged by our guest today. Nick was with us in the studio, and I understand, Nick Mattis, that you're the fellow that actually made that a video of that visit to the Lake County Public Library possible.
Yeah, well, I had a copy of it, and I called the library, and I wanted to see if they had the actual 3/4-inch tape that it was used to tape that event. And sure enough, you know, they couldn't find it because they were doing the renovations. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe about, what, 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, at least, yeah.
So I kind of stayed on them for about a year, year and a half. And finally, in one of their warehouses, they found a box of some of the few remaining materials that were Gene Shepherd related in their warehouse. And I was so glad. So they made the copy and they put it up online so all of us can enjoy it. So,
that's great. Yeah. I was just only to have a chance to put, like I said, about 3.5 minutes of this on the air, and this mm-hmm. is a much longer conversation.
It's an hour.
But it's a very, I kind of skimmed through the last part of it mm-hmm. just to catch it, and you'll find it very interesting. And we know that we bring you Sundays with Shep on every single week here on Lakeshore Public Radio, and you get to hear Gene Shepherd, the storyteller, as he actually was on New York City Radio.
W-R.
And this is a very interesting way to get to hear Gene Shepherd in his later years,
right.
Before a crowd here in Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. And he didn't always come back very often, especially in his latter years, did he?
No, you know, after this event that I'm aware of, he came for an IU, Indiana University, honorary degree that they bestowed upon him. And it was basically 1995, I believe, but I don't know mm-hmm. the month. And Professor Lane got a hold of me, and I went through all the correspondence and all the nomination and the you know, things that were going back and forth between the board members. It was pretty interesting to see, you know. But being the fact that Gene Shepherd at that time had made an impact on the media, you know, they gave him the degree. But he never really did graduate Indiana University. Mm-hmm. But he came up here in Northwest Indiana. I believe it was Calumet College at that time with a connection to Indiana University.
Right.
Or I should say Indiana University, where Calumet College is now, in the Whiting campus. And he took, some classes there, but nothing to, you know, really steer him into communications and radio, you know, like we would say today. He basically, you know, started off when he was at Hammond High on WJOB reading some of the high school football and baseball scores
right.
and things
mm-hmm.
of that nature, basketball, I should say. And then he went to the war. He got drafted and went to the war, and he came back, and then he worked at WJOB for a short time. And then he got a job offer. He ended up in Cleveland, and then he landed in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And then from there, he spent a couple years bounce around station to station. And the story from the folks in Cincinnati tell me that, you know, Shepherd got fired from his first three jobs, basically, because he couldn't stop talking in between the songs that he was playing on the radio. He was hired, basically, to just play music.
Oh, right.
And he started with a little story here and there, and, you know, that's really Gene's legacy, is the fact that he loved to tell stories and talk. And he got fired, and the audience members, the fans, people that were out there in the public, they called the station back and said, you know, who was that guy? We want to hear more of that. That's what we want to hear, basically. And, you know, Shepherd used to really get down on management and talk about and criticize the fact that what are we doing here in radio? You know, we're having a radio producer, a music producer show up with his musician, play their record so they can make money. They leave town and, you know, but what are we, you know, and then we getting really nothing out of it, basically. And so he wanted to use radio for more than just playing records. And I think at the time, you know, some people give him credit for the talk format that he has, where he just showed up for about an hour, a little under an hour, and speak and tell stories or whatever it may be. And so he didn't have guest call-ins.
He
didn't interview anybody to talk about their movie or their radio show or whatever, their music. He basically used radio to get to talk to you. Basically.
In fact, just recently here, one of the Sundays with Shep episodes that we had on that Ryan Priest picked out was one of the conversations that Gene Shepherd had with one of his colleagues at the time, who also had a talk show on WOR Radio in New York, Long John Neble, who was considered one of the founding fathers of talk radio.
Yep.
When you realize they really both were, in a way, in their own special sort of way.
Yep.
Long John may have been on maybe earlier in the evening before Shep was on, but Shep was the fellow who held the listeners all through the overnight hours.
Yeah,
my people, you know, the crew, you know, the people that worked overnight in the factories and the bakeries and the places that
the night people,
I guess, is the clean way of putting
right.
And they were the ones that were particular fans of Gene Shepherd, and luckily he was able to connect with them. And even though maybe most of these people were from East Coast, they never even heard of Indiana, much less of Holman, Indiana, or Hammond, Indiana.
Right.
They still could connect with him because of the way they could see it in their own minds through his voice telling the stories that we all get to know and love now.
Yeah, he just made it so so beautifully simple in a way of putting it. And, you know, talking about your childhood, he would hit all those elements about your childhood that you can relate to no matter where you're from. He may have used Hammond as a backdrop of his stories because that's where he grew up. But in a sense, that kid living out in New Jersey or New York or anywhere up and down that East Coast that all these people for 21, 22 years were, you know, able to hear his shows live most of the nights during the weekday. And, you know, just wonderful stories. And I can just imagine what it was like to have those little transistor radios at the time, you know, and pulling out that antenna, you know, around 11 o'clock, you know, trying to dial in WOR and catching his voice. And a lot of people, you know, from Pennsylvania, Ron Simon, the curator of the Paley Center, he told me basically that, you know, he lived in Pennsylvania, and he was, you know, one winter night, he's going through the airwaves trying to catch some entertainment in the middle of the night, and he heard a faint voice, and he stayed on it, and it was Shepherd, and, you know, he heard a couple stories about the steel mills or whatever it might be, and it fascinated him, and he stayed on it. The same with a buddy of Shepherd's, Ron DeLaCisa, in Boston.
In fact, you talked with him, and he is in the documentary entitled Shep. Yeah. Here's what Ron had to say to Nick Mattis here some time ago when he first got a chance to learn about Shep, actually hearing him on that.
He was a real close personal friend of Shep's.
Radio, yes.
Yeah.
Like a lot of other people at night, I would scan the radio. It had knobs. In those days, radios had knobs. And I would scan the radio, and I'd be listening, and I'd hear Frank Sinatra, and I'd hear a classical music station, then I'd hear a news broadcast. And then all of a sudden, I came across this voice. And it was a voice of somebody I had never heard. But he was telling this wonderful story about working in a steel mill in Hammond, Indiana. And he said, "Do you know what it's really like to work in a steel mill in the summer? Do you know what that's like? I bet none of you have experienced what I've experienced." And I stayed there. And like a sorcerer, he brought me in. He seduced me into his world at that moment. And from then on, I listened to him every night on WOR, where he was doing these long monologue shows interspersed with music. And every night was different. He'd create a different adventure in your mind. And I imagine what this man looked like. I couldn't conceive of what he looked like because he was this anonymous voice coming out of the radio, but captivating me in a way that no one else had ever done. But even more so, the ability to draw you in. In other words, once you were listening to Gene, there was no way you could stop. Because he was like a drug. I think that's a good way to describe him.
Ron DeLaCisa, who is a Boston radio personality, who in turn was enticed as a kid by listening to Gene Shepherd, the fella of which the documentary Shep is being put together by our guest here in studio, Nick Mattis. This has been a labor of love, and it seems like a long time labor of love. You've been working on this project. Tell us about how involved it is. All the people, well, you can't mention all the people, a lot of people involved in this, and a lot of snippets get to put together that will tell a very good picture to the viewer of what Gene Shepherd's really like.
Well, as we were talking just before we went on the air, there's so many different facets of Gene Shepherd. I mean, if he was just an actor and I was doing a documentary or just an actor, my scope is so much more focused and narrow. Mm-hmm. But in Shepherd's case, not only, you know, he started off telling stories on radio and he had a radio career, which is fascinating within itself, and a documentary within itself. But then you talk about his book writing, his live appearances that he made, his personal side of his life, the impact that he made on media that people, I hope, will watch the documentary eventually and see the different things he did and the different people from writers to producers to nuclear physicists. I mean, the guy, I can't recall his name, the chess player who was a kid, protege, what was his name? Bobby Fischer.
Bobby Fischer, yes.
You know, who used to stalk Shepard. I mean, you know, then you got Spielberg who put Wonder Years together based on Shepard's stories about growing up in Hammond, and that's basically the Wonder Years. Then you got Hugh Hefner, you know, enjoying his writing, the way he wrote, and sending him off to England to hang out with a boy band called the Beatles, 63-64, you know, for a couple weeks. And so there's just so many, you know, Dee Snider is a current, you know, name I could throw out there, people relate, but, you know, we're not going to take it. Yeah. That's a part of a Shepard spoof that he did on the radio where he had everybody put their radio on a windowsill and he would yell, you know, we're not going to take it anymore, or something to that extent. And that came from the movie network as well.
Now, fill us in on the latest on how you're doing. I guess at some point you're finishing up with the interviews for the documentary.
Yep, right? The interviews, I'm going to New York, New Jersey. I got to go to North Carolina. There's a few people there. Florida, there's all kinds of things going on in Florida there. And I'm still, you know, and there's a person out in California that I'd like to go out and interview. And, you know, and there's a few other people here and there, but Matthew Broderick is one that just confirmed he'd want to do an interview. And, you know, he just did the musical live. He was a narrator that was on Fox just recently. Mm-hmm. But what many people may not know is that his father, James Broderick, was the old man during the PBS series that Shepard used to put together out in, with the Boston crew. And so I'm told by many people that worked with James Broderick that he was a fascinating man, a very gracious actor, and, you know, just a nice guy to be around. And Matthew, you know, really looked up to his father. And so this is a chance to revisit some of his father's and his own role with Shepard.
Now, when you get a chance to get all the film together or tape, whichever the case may be, and get doing the editing work, what's your goal for getting this off so that we can all get to enjoy the documentary?
Okay, so, you know, I don't know whether you realize it or not, but I'm using Shepard's own voice to narrate his own life story, even though he's been, you know, he passed away in 1999. I don't want to say the word dead for some reason because the guy in my head is still alive. And to many people who listen to this guy, you know, he's got his podcast out there. We have here at the local, you know, Lakeshore Radio, Sundays with Shep. The guy is going to be around for a long time. You know, I kind of worry, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to avoid your question, but I'll get to it. But the guy, you know, it takes him 40 minutes, 45 minutes to make a point, to entertain you with various different stories, but I guess a theme or a message. Today we have that instant, you know, I need a two-liner and entertain me, you know. And so that's the only word that I have, but I think people eventually will, you know, succumb to that and be patient, listen to them. But, you know, the interviews are wrapping up. I'll have a teaser. I have another teaser I've been working on, but with this Matthew Broderick interview, I want to add him on that as well. But, you know, I would have to say sometime in late spring is probably when I'll have definitely a pilot where I can actually shop around and to local art and music festivals and things of that nature and really try and bring Shepard to the forefront. And I'm working on the screenplay as well while I'm doing this. I'm trying to do two things at once.
Well, you have all these things, all these possible ideas together. You might as well work at them if you can.
You know, I look at Leonardo DiCaprio, and I would love to see Leonardo DiCaprio play Shepard. Well, I mean, you know, and it would be very fascinating. And maybe the way that you could do it, too, maybe using Shepard's voice and have Leo lip-syncing it, you know, because everybody's so used to that Shepard voice, you know. So that would be quite a challenge for Leo. And he pulls off the look. If you ever look at the pictures he has with the goatee and the piercing blue eyes, he looks just like Gene Shepard.
We've been talking with Nick Mattis, who is the creator of the Gene Shepard documentary, is going to be known as simply Shep, and we're looking forward to that, Nick, and thank you for spending time with us.
I appreciate the time.
Give us an update here. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
We're just about to the end of 2017, looking ahead to 2018, and as far as Northwest Indiana is concerned for the housing stock that we are looking at here, we check in on Peter Novak, who's the president and CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. And we check with him on time to time to find out how a particular month's home sales and the costs and all are doing. We'll take a little broader look here. Look at what we see so far for the year that's just about to end. Pete, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Let's take a look first here. We'll look at November. So that's the latest data that you happen to have available. And how do things seem to shape up here for the housing here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, you know, the market conditions have been pretty similar all year, and really for the last couple of years. It's just a situation where demand remains high, and that part we continue to remain excited about, but really continue to be constrained by low supply, low inventory of homes for sale. And it's been something that, I don't want to call it a mystery, but certainly I've asked my members often why sellers aren't selling, and I don't seem to get a consensus answer. But the one consensus that we can say for sure is that there's a lot of buyer demand out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess in a way that's good. I mean, the people want to buy houses, but it's really tough, though, I'm sure, if you don't have enough houses to sell or not the, quite the ones that people seem to want.
Well, it does. It makes it tough because certainly we're of the opinion more home sales could occur if there was more supply, more houses for sale. And the other downside to not having enough supply is that prices continue to increase, which is good if you are an existing homeowner, but bad if you are a home buyer.
Yeah.
Because that means you're going to pay more for the home than you probably want to. But that's just, you know, the current status of the market today.
Now, we know that the Greater Association has seven counties within its purview. Are there any counties in particular that seem to have more problems with either the number of homes available or the sales or the cost per home?
No, I mean, it's across the board. This is a national problem, and certainly you could look at 1 month's data and see discrepancies or ups and downs. But I think overall, if you looked at the overall numbers, it's fairly consistent. You know, home sales are slightly outpacing what they were last year. And, of course, median selling price, once again, like it has for the last two or three years, is up pretty high. I think this year we're 6.6% for all counties year to date in terms of the median selling price. As of through November, so for the first 11 months of the year, we're up 1.6% in terms of the total number of units sold. Last year was, you know, a very good year in terms of the number of units sold. So, you know, if we match that or surpass it, which is the way it looks like we'll do, we'll consider that to be a successful year. But, again, prices rising are a good thing, but rising too much certainly for the long term can be a concern as well.
Mm-hmm. When you take a look at across the board at all of the counties together within the association, and you talk with your fellow realtors and the locations in whatever county they happen to be in, do they tell you any particular things that they note that they've run into here so far to the year, at this point here in the year, where they've had trouble trying to sell homes or look for the right kind of homes for clients that they've had?
Well, not necessarily. Again, I would say it's been across the board, but I think, you know, you can look at and see sort of the entry-level homes, the lower-priced homes are the ones that are being competed for a mm-hmm. little bit more heavily. While it is true there's low supply also on the high end of the market, that end of the market's a little bit more fluid. Obviously, you have less buyers generally on the higher end. So I would say, you know, mostly on the first-time home buying, it's been a little bit of a struggle. So those, you know, lower-priced homes, I think, are the ones that are certainly there's more competition for. So I would probably say that in the market is definitely a little bit more fierce.
That's interesting because I don't drive around and look specifically for houses, at least not anymore anyway. But mm-hmm. when I was looking around, and I noticed even now, just without having to have a reason to look, I do see a lot of for sale signs out, and we're talking about sales signs that are put up not only by registered realtors, but also in some cases by individuals looking to sell their particular home. And I realize in some cases that we have people here that are maybe they're empty nesters now. They have all their family members out, and it's just the husband and wife and the family, and they realize that they don't necessarily need this big a house to take care of any longer. So, and even if we're talking here about a home that would probably be a perfect first-time home for somebody.
Yeah, again, I mean, one of the issues when you have a low supply market is that there's various different relief valves that occur. I mean, we've talked about new construction in the past being a relief valve for us, and I know the home builders have said this year that things have picked up as well. I've talked to people just about general new developments in terms of entire subdivisions. When you look at that, that's something that has not necessarily matched, if you will, some of the numbers that we were seeing in the mid-2000s. But in talking to people, they're telling me they're starting to see those things come more online. So those would be, again, be things that would be relief valves. And usually when people say new construction, a lot of people think of the nice luxury home or, you know, the high-end home, and that's not necessarily true. I mean, we're, you know, again, you can see developments that might cater more towards not necessarily first-time home buyers, because certainly they have usually a more difficult time purchasing new construction with just some of the down payment requirements and all of that stuff. But for people on sort of that end of the market, that certainly is a segment that, you know, we haven't seen as robust as we have in the past. And those are things that I'm hearing are improving, and hopefully that'll be the case here in the coming year, where we'll start to see some of that stuff take shape and start to relieve this whole supply issue. Or, again, we could start to see where sellers just finally start, you know, putting their homes up for sale for whatever reasons that they do, whether they're, you know, again, moving up or moving down, whether they're feeling better about the economy. I know we had obviously a big tax cut that just occurred, and so who knows how that'll change people's opinions about where things are going. And all of those things factor in when someone decides to sell. And a lot of times, as we mentioned, the interest rates can be as low as possible. You could think you're getting a tax cut, but there's usually life-changing reasons why people end up selling a home. You mentioned it. Kids are grown. They went to college, and people are trying to downgrade.
Right.
Or obviously they're expanding their family and are looking for more, you know, more house to be able to put their family in. So all of those things combined kind of make up whether we have people that are willing to sell and also buy. And so I think they're kind of good problems to have. I don't want to make it seem like we're not excited. I mean, we just, as long as demand stays high in my book, that'll be a good thing for the housing market.
So I suppose if we got together, say, in March or April of next year, when things seem to have shaken out a bit more here concerning the tax reform changes that Congress has passed and have been signed into law, and people actually get to see what kind of changes that they will actually get to face here, or, you know, in whenever they have decided to make their big moves here in the future, they might have something different to say. Certainly we'll have a better idea, too, on how the housing market is going to be into 2018 by then, I would think.
Yeah, sure. Again, I mean, I think all indications at this point from a lot of the analysts we follow and things of that nature that, you know, we're going to see a positive 2018. I think the question for us is how much better could it be? I mean, can we start to see some of these things that we're pointing to as constraints and issues? Can some of those things start to work themselves out in the market? And that's kind of what we'll be watching for in the coming year.
Okay. Peter Novak is the president and CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. 7 counties here in Northwest Indiana come under the association. And as always, Pete, thanks for taking time to talk with us today. And happy holidays to you and everybody there at the association. We appreciate you sharing the information with us. We'll look forward to talking again here pretty soon into 2018.
My pleasure, Chris, and likewise to you and Lakeshore Public Radio as well.
Won't be long before the General Assembly is back in session in Indianapolis, and let's check in with one of the members of Northwest Indiana's delegation. House Lager is Republican, and he is also represents House District Number 15, which includes the communities of Dyer and Schererville and St. John Township and portions of St. John and Griffith as well, too. Hal, thanks for being with us today here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you.
Well, as we take a look at some of the things that are going to come up here as the 2018 session gets underway, what's your take on what you feel are going to be some of the big issues this time around, since this is the short session, only 30 days altogether in meeting days, and we don't have a state budget we have to put together this time around?
Right. Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. This short session was designed to handle the incidentals, and of course we have a fair amount of those where the little repairs needed, the prior bills and whatnot, but it has developed into much more than that, where we end up handling some fairly meaty issues. This year, of course, most people have probably heard there's discussion on putting something in place on how we're going to deal with water infrastructure that is failing throughout the state, so that we don't have a situation like they did in Flint, Michigan. We're trying to get ahead of that.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably also heard about Sunday sales and liquor. This has been ongoing for years that people have been interested in, but because of the way the laws are designed in Indiana, just doesn't allow for that. And then a whole host of other things that on bills that may be filed but not get heard. Most folks probably don't realize that you'll read in the paper or hear on the radio that, in fact, some some bill has been filed, and folks might be thinking, what are they thinking? Well, that doesn't mean that the bill's going to go anywhere. Any bill can be filed. It doesn't mean it'll get a hearing and go any further than that.
Right, I see. Let's just take up kind of a list of some of the topics we know that are of interest, certainly, and what might turn into some bills. Somebody will pull, no doubt, take it up as a topic and file something on it in time. Let's talk here a little bit first here about education, in particular about public schools. And I know that there are a number of things that may be discussed this time around. One of the things I understand that may possibly come up is how big a school district should be.
Right. Well, I'm not on the education committee, so I don't know specifically what their priorities will be, but mm-hmm. The problem that we see is that there are so many dollars going toward administration of schools rather than necessarily getting to the classroom, and so there's talk about trying to provide incentives in some way to encourage a little consolidation there. It's not so much the case in our area, because we have fairly good-sized school districts as a rule, but we have lots of rural school districts that really struggle with this.
I can imagine they probably, in some places out, not necessarily in your district, of course, since it's urban, but I know in some of your colleagues, even South Lake County, you know, you get out there in some of the communities out that way, and they have rural school districts, they have to probably have to deal with that as well, too.
Well, and the biggest problem, that is all correct, but Chris, but the biggest concern is a slow reduction in school population. You'll hear administrators and teachers complain about the fact that they're not getting as much money as they used to, which on one side is true, on the other side it's not. We keep raising the amount of dollars per student, but when you consider the fact that in many school districts, even mine in Lake Central, mm-hmm. they're seeing a somewhat of a decline in school population, which means that's about $6,000 per student they're not receiving. So if they're down 100 students, that's a lot of dollars. Mm-hmm. And in the rural areas, that's especially the case when they're operating on a small budget, not just thin, but small in and of itself, because they only have 1,000, 1,500 students, they lose 20 students, they really feel it.
Now, we're talking with State Representative Hal Slager, who's Republican here in Lake County, and some of the issues that are likely to come up as the General Assembly gets underway for another short session here very soon. I know one topic I'm sure is going to have to come up, it's been discussed already, is dealing with the opioid crisis, not only here in Northwest Indiana, but elsewhere in Indiana. Tell us what you might see may possibly be discussed during the session.
Right. Well, and it's not just all of Indiana. It's all over the country. We seem to have a real problem with it. And in the last couple of sessions, we've been working on this where we've restricted the amount that doctors can prescribe to 7 days because we have a real problem with pilfering where we have, you know, people stealing drugs out of medicine cabinets, and of course they're prescription drugs, and people get hooked on them, and then when the prescription's out or when the doctor quits writing them, they've got to find an alternate. And I know the medical community has become very much aware of this, but we've put a number of mechanisms in place, and the real focus this last year was not on penalizing people, but helping them recover and get past this so that they can move on with their life. And I expect we'll see many more of those types of bills in this next session.
Now, you kind of mentioned here at the start of our conversation here about the possibility that we might see something come up involving a Sunday liquor sales of some sort. And we know that they've already had some discussions, I guess, at study committee in the recent months here about this. So you think something will shape up in some kind of report from this study committee that lawmakers may actually look at in some form of a bill this session coming up?
I really do. The problem that we face when we're changing the rules of the game, if you will, mm-hmm. and we've got these liquor laws that have been around for decades or longer, and people have built businesses around those rules, for better or worse. And when you start changing the rules, you're going to have winners and losers. That's the most difficult part of our job is when we're put into that position. And there are the different factions that have very different opinions. Liquor store owners don't want to be open on Sundays, and the big retailers with lots of floor space don't want that to be dead space for a day. And so I think what we've done, we've made it pretty clear last year that we're going to have to deal with this. And I always tell people, if you just allow the legislature to do it their way, you're guaranteed to be unhappy. So I've seen the different factions here trying to come together to come up with something that is more agreeable than if we just do it on our own. And so I do anticipate we're going to get there to some degree. Now, we have lots of liquor laws besides Sunday sales that need to be addressed. And I don't know how much of that we're going to get into in this session, but I do believe we're going to see some real movement on Sunday sales.
One other topic I know is more national, like the opioid crisis that we're dealing with is the issue of immigration. We know that we have cities that have become welcoming cities, in particular here in Lake County and the like. Do you think that maybe that some discussion is going to come up during the session, even though there's not a lot of time to talk about it, about the issue of DACA in particular, and that's an issue we know that Congress is trying to work out right now, but something that the Hoosier legislators may be able to talk about?
Well, this is a difficult situation because Congress won't act, and for several years our federal government really hasn't been enforcing the laws like they should. And so now we're in a situation that's unfortunate where we have, in effect, allowed lots of people to enter this country illegally. And because they're not legal citizens, they don't have the rights that legal citizens do. And I just see us being in a position where we're creating citizens that may young citizens that may be just angry citizens,
right.
And that's no good either.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, the one issue that I keep hearing rolling around, and in fact I've even put it out on my next survey, is as it relates to these young people that have gotten good grades, they've been in school and not gotten into trouble, and in every respect, they act like good citizens. They're just technically not citizens because they were brought here at a very young age,
right.
The DACA situation you talked mm-hmm. about, and whether that or not they should receive in-state tuition rates if they go to college. Again, this falls under the heading of what kind of citizens do we want to deal with. I absolutely believe that you need to come into this country legally, but at some point, we've got to face the reality. We've got an awful lot of illegal folks in this country, and how do we want to handle this in a reasonable manner?
I see. One other topic, too, I know that has been brought up by some other comments here in the past here is related and is more of a national issue, but has certainly been discussed here in Indiana, is the issue of hate crimes. Do you think there might be some discussion in the General Assembly, the session, about that?
I do. Most people don't realize that our code already accounts for special circumstances such as this. It's just not explicitly stated.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at some point in time we're just, in order to move the conversation, we're going to have to deal with this at some level. So I might expect to see something there as well.
And, of course, not only do we have these issues that come up here, they'll be discussed, no doubt, we have another set of elections, the 2018 elections, the primaries, and, of course, the general election in November. Do you think there might be any discussions about that? And I know that you have brought up in the past as well here in Northwest Indiana about dealing of with redistricting as well, too. Do you think any of this is going to resurface in the session?
I really don't know on some of these and how much time we're going to have. You have to remember we only have 10 weeks,
yeah.
And so it's we've got about 3 weeks for each house to hear the first set of bills, and then a few days break, and then back for another 3-4 weeks for the next round to hear the other house's bills, and then we go into conference committee. So just how much we get to is uncertain.
I see. Well, let me ask you now, are there any particular bills or topics that you're going to bring up when you get your chance to do so in Indianapolis this session?
Well, we have a couple of things that are again, cleanups from prior years,
right.
That we're going to see. I've had, interestingly, a number of people come to me with ideas, but unfortunately we're past the the drafting deadline. So if we do something, it would have to, for those folks, it would probably have to be in the form of an amendment. One of them, of course, is should we be paying elected officials who were incarcerated? This is a real question mark.
We have some situations as we speak about dealing with these things too. Yeah, so I imagine that they probably other lawmakers across the state that you meet with in Indianapolis probably bring the subject up, or if they haven't, they will, I'm sure.
Right. The other thing that I'm working on, and I don't have any expectation it's actually going to get a vote this time. Good bills usually take some time to develop, and one of them we're seeing is there's a couple of municipalities or government units that are struggling, much like we saw with the Gary School Corporation. And in their case, we were writing them checks and giving them loans for some years before we finally had the DUAB come in, the Distress Unit Appeals Board, and then ultimately taking over the district, which,
right,
by the way, nobody wanted to do. And we need to, number one, do everything we can to avoid that in the future, as well as put some hooks in place that those entities realize if the state's going to come in and provide assistance, what are our expectations going to be in managing that? And so last year I had a bill where the state examiner's findings could actually go somewhere. Before, he'd write a report and it had no teeth. Now he can take it to a higher level if those issues are not addressed when he comes back the next year. A follow-up to that would be what kind of spending controls would be put in place in the event that we provided state assistance. So that's the next bill I'm looking at developing to deal with that before it becomes personal, before we're talking about a specific government unit or municipality or school district, whatever it may be. We can deal with that kind of generically so that everybody knows what the rules will be going forward.
State Representative Hal Slager is Republican. He has this House District number 15, which includes communities of Dyer and Schererville and St. John Township, and he's also had portions of St. John and Griffith in his district as well, too. Thank you very much for being with us. A lot of things to talk about and a lot of things that will, I'm sure, come up for discussion, at least get kicked around, at least in discussion in Indianapolis here, whether it actually turns into a bill and whether it actually, I guess, goes through the process. We'll just have to wait and see about that. Thank you for spending, though, some time with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
Indeed, Chris. Thanks for calling, and call me anytime.
Hi, I'm Mindy with Mindy Abair and the Bone Shakers.
The Bone Shakers.
The famous and not so famous musical talents every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Midwest Beat with Tom Lounges. It's an hour of music, stories, and fun. Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on the Lakeshore.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
It's difficult to be poor in the USA. When you go into an apartment complex and you ask for income-based housing, you're automatically put into a category. You're automatically separated from the rest of society. They treat you differently. Even to get an application is difficult. But when you get the application and you sit down to try to write it out, there's no one to help you. My niece has special needs, and her husband went to the Portage Township because they were being evicted from their apartment. They went for help. And they didn't get any help because they didn't understand how to fill out the application. No one offered to help them. They were sitting there struggling and finally just gave up. I look at the example of housing opportunities when I filled out my application for housing. They were kind, respectful, honest, and compassionate. When I filled out my application for the food pantry in Portage. She wanted to know why, you know, why my daughter didn't have a job, why I didn't have a job. You know, it wasn't enough just to answer the questions. I almost felt like we were being interrogated about our decisions in life. It was kind of a very humiliating situation because Portage does have a really nice food pantry and you get some really nice things, but it was being abused by people who didn't really live in the area or just lying on their applications. And so because of that, now we have to go to the Portage Township and we have to get a waiver. So my daughter and I went to the Portage Township, and because my daughter is in school full time and she's not working, the lady who took our application just didn't understand that. She made us feel very low. It made me kind of angry afterwards in the car. I'm like, I don't want to go to that person and ask for help because they help you, but they do it begrudgingly. Poor people are looked down upon so badly that we're just trash and that we've done something bad in our lives, or we're bad people because we've ended up in a certain situation. Well, guess what? There's a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck. I let myself get knocked down sometimes. I do. But then I have to go to myself, my inner self, my inner strength. I have to almost take myself out of my situation and really look at it. And ask myself, am I doing everything possible that I can to support myself and my children? Am I doing everything possible I can to advance my life? And I am. I'm doing everything I can. I'm not such a bad person. I just have some bad situations.
You can find more original stories at welcomeprojectoneword.valpo.edu. Well, just this week left to make your adjustments to your financial plan going into 2018, and we offer some year-end advice from Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer.
I think at the end of the year is just an excellent time to begin to look at where your contributions are, especially with your retirement accounts, because that's often the time that you can have an open enrollment, change contribution levels. And it's also a time where you have a pretty accurate idea, you know, where your income is going to land for the year, whether you're eligible for additional contributions to possibly a Roth IRA or a spousal IRA, or you know, whether or not conversions might make sense, because you have more accurate data than you would say in January of, you know, of that year.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about spousal contributions. How's that likely to be possible?
So everybody is eligible to do a spousal contributions based on whether or not they have a group plan that they're eligible to contribute to, and then income levels. So whether or not you have a deductible contribution is based on some parameters. Everybody can make a contribution to an IRA, but the key is whether or not it is actually deductible, and then whether you should look at a traditional versus a Roth, because mm-hmm. the limits are different. And oftentimes it's difficult to determine, you know, where you're going to land for total income until you get into December.
Now, you talk about those two types of individual retirement accounts. For folks that are not familiar with this, tell us about the difference between the traditional IRA and a Roth IRA.
Sure. So, basically, the government allows generally three types of tax treatments. One, you can have a deduction. Two, you can have deferred growth. So, while it's growing in that account, there's no 1099s or nothing that lands on your tax return. And then third, the distribution could be tax-free. Mm-hmm. What they don't allow is for to have all three of those. So the traditional IRA is about, you know, what your tax benefits would be in terms of taking off the return in today's income level and getting the deduction today and having the deferred growth, where the Roth IRA would be more about how we can mitigate the tax liability in the future. So we don't take the deduction today, but we have deferred growth, but then distributions don't impact the tax return. We don't have to pay taxes on them. Mm.
That's the advantage of switching over from one to the Roth?
Yeah, and again, it doesn't always make sense to go all the way to the Roth. For example, a lot of folks their higher tax bracket, you know, may be while they're working, and the way they're going to structure their income in retirement, they may never be in a higher tax bracket. So, you know, their benefit might be taking the deduction today. And that's just part of what you want to look at and consider, you know, just in your overall retirement planning, you know, what are your objectives? What type of income are you going to look to have in retirement, and the things that you're doing, is it realistic? And then decide, you know, where is it better to mitigate taxes, today or in the future? Okay. Generally, I tell people it's a little bit of both, because we don't know where the government's going to land year to year with, you know, even what tax brackets are going to be.
I see. Okay. Well, we talk here about investing in oneself here. Another way we should look into taking a look into the new year is to reducing your tax bill. And such a good time to talk about that now, because we only have just a matter of days before the end of the month. And in particular, the opportunity to claim charitable deductions. That's obviously one way that you can reduce your tax bill if you can get that in there, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people will do regular tithing and gift giving throughout the year. But again, at the end of the year, if it's a situation where you have some monies that you might want to earmark towards a charity, it would always be beneficial, especially if you're itemizing in a year where you might not be itemizing the following year, to consider giving that particular organization that you favor some type of charitable giving, which would allow you to reduce your tax bill.
Now, obviously, you have to be sure, if you haven't thought about this before, that you have to be sure that you have enough, I suppose, in your charitable giving list to be able to earn that deduction. Because I know that the Internal Revenue Service won't let you just put every little dollar in. You've got to have a big chunk, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So what it means basically is, as most people progress towards retirement, the normal things that they have the list as itemized deductions are reduced or often even go away. For example, a lot of people don't carry mortgage interest into retirement. Mm-hmm. So when you start it, or they're not earning as much as when they were younger, so they don't have the state taxes on there for deductions. So if you don't pass your standard deduction, you can't itemize the charitable contributions. So it becomes a little bit more difficult. Standard deduction is over $12,000. So for a lot of folks, they don't even have that much with itemized deductions. So even though they're giving money to a charitable organization, it may not impact taxes at all for them.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, end of the year financial tips, and continuing on a little list here. Another thing that we should look into, if we haven't already, is to rebalance your assets.
Yeah, and I think this is probably one of the things that are most easy to overlook in the planning process. Because when you first create a plan and you evaluate your risk tolerance and you create an allocation, there's going to be a tendency for that allocation to get warped. What I mean by that, Chris, is you look at the last 9 years. Market's done really well. So if I was 50% in a balanced allocation, let's say bonds and equities, the equities have well outperformed bonds over the last 9 years. So by the sheer growth of that equity side of the portion, you're no longer a 50-50 balance. So that's where you want to make sure that you're bringing back your balance to where you want it to be, so there's not a shock value when the market does correct, and all of a sudden you're 70-30 when you were in your mind the entire time being 50-50. And that's why a lot of people will use models, because it will automatically rebalance. And then also you just want to make sure that your risk tolerance is still the same from 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 8 years ago. Generally, as things change over individuals and families' lifetime, a lot of times their priorities change and then their risk tolerance will change as well. So it's always good to evaluate, in my opinion, at least annually, you know, where your allocations are, reassess your risk tolerance, and make sure that the plan is what you understand it to be.
Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer here on Regionally Speaking. That's it for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.